Welcome into the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf. I'm Ryan Lavner, soon to be joined by Rex Hoggard, who was on the ground all week at Royal St. George's for the Open Championship. Looking forward to getting Rex's thoughts on Colin Morikawa's history-making major, Jordan Spieth's spirited run, and everything else that went down at the year's final major. Now, normally, this is where we would tell you about the equipment that Jon Rahm used to finish top eight in all four major championships in 2021, including, of course, his breakthrough victory at the U.S. Open. But instead, let's hear from the man himself.
For all those people that might have doubted the manufacturer change, you know, there was a reason why I believed I could get better. And the new ball and the new irons allowed me to hit certain shots that I simply wasn't capable before. And it showed, you know, some of those wet shots and some of those long shots at 8-iron and one. I mean, being able to hit that shot high with spin, but still go through the wind and hit it short of the pin, and many others like that, is what allowed me to stay as aggressive. So I need to say a huge thank to that, to the team in Callaway. You know, I gave them a headache. I don't know how many putters they've built for me to find the one I needed. And, you know, I'm pretty sure I found the one I need. This one's working really well. So, Joe, thank you for all the hard work. And we got one, boys. So I guess second one of the year.
Now, to learn more about Rahm's gear, visit callaway.golf.com/Rahm. Now, Rex, you were in England. You are back. We had to tape this podcast a little bit later in the morning because you were jet lagged beyond belief. Of course, you're only home for a couple of days before you depart for Tokyo and the delayed Olympic Games. How are you feeling? You tired?
You know what? I should have gone the other way. When you texted me yesterday asking me about this morning, I was up at 5:30 because of the jet lag going the other way. Of course, I didn't really think it through, obviously. And so I'm thinking to myself, I should have told him, let's just tape it at 5:30. Like, I was up ready to go. It was all I could do not to send you a Snapchat this morning at 5:30. Be like, hey, ready? Let's go. Come on. Let's make the podcast now.
I mean, I was up. I do have a 2.5-year-old who is very much ready to play by the time that 6:30 rolls around. Want to get to your impressions of the Open Championship. To me, it was an incredibly memorable golf tournament with Colin Morikawa winning by 2 shots over Jordan Spieth. Jon Rahm made a pretty spirited rally on the final day as well. Just kind of, what was your big takeaway from Morikawa's second major victory in just 8 career starts in the major championships?
I don't want to dance around this. Let's both just embrace our great shame. Are you ready? I want us just
a great both shame.
Great shame for both of us. Are you ready? Like, I've already thought this through. Let's don't dance around it. Let's don't wait to get to it. I'm going to sink right into it.
I don't think we mentioned him on the preview podcast.
No. If production values for this podcast were just a little bit better, I'm sure that someone could dig up a clip of me saying that I don't trust Colin Morikawa, that I'm suspect about his putting, that I didn't think.
You haven't said this just once. You've said this
numerous times.
Repeatedly.
It would be so easy to find any clip, anytime. Almost, you're right. I didn't do it last week, thankfully. That would have been way too easy and way too harsh on me. But I'm going to own it. And I'm going to continue to own it. Because before I get to my next point of shame, which is your shame, and trust me, we should both own our shame on this one. Going into this, and I wrote this Sunday night, yes, he was fantastic. He did exactly at Royal St. George's what he did at TPC Harding Park at the PGA Championship. He was first in putts, ninth in putts per GIR. They don't have strokes gained putting at the Open Championship, but my guess is
they don't have much of anything for the Open Championship. They don't have shot tracker. They don't have any sort of usable stats. It's like going back to the dark ages.
It kind of is. It's kind of sad. But if they did have strokes gained putting, my guess is he would have been phenomenal at that as well. And statistically, I didn't even notice this. This is totally on me. And this morning, I was just kind of looking over some stats. He only hit into one greenside bunker. He was 1-for-1 for the week in sand saves. That's Tiger-esque. That's absolutely amazing. But I'm going to stick with my same concept here. And I wrote this Sunday, as well as he putted last week, and he did putt well last week, going into that tournament, 172nd strokes gained putting on the PGA Tour this season, 79th in 3-putt avoidance, 141st in putting from 5 feet, which is kind of an important range when you talk about the Open Championship. I'm going to defend myself only in as much to say that I was wrong in my take. I will own it when I'm wrong in my take. But statistically, I still feel like, all right, I had a point. I feel like my point is still valid. He's a wonderful player. Watching him swing his long irons is like golf porn, man. Like, it is amazing to watch him do that. The putting, I'm still suspect.
He is a wonderful player. So you are saying that Colin Morikawa, who is by any metric possible, a now a historic player. He is the first player in history to win two different majors in his debut. He is the only player besides Tiger to win the Open Championship, the PGA Championship before the age of 25. And yet you are still not sold. You are essentially saying that he fluked into those major championship victories because he putted well. That is essentially what you're saying.
No. Now you're putting words in my mouth. Fluke never came out. I would never think that. I mean, look, he's won enough. He's proven enough on.
Just called him a wonderful player. That's like saying, bless your heart, Colin.
Oh, no. I didn't mean it that way. I mean, I think, no, that's like, yeah, this is Brooks Koepka saying I can put up with anybody for 1 week. Right. I mean, that's gotta be that's not
even you.
Yeah. Even you, I can even put up with you for 1 week. No. I think what I'm trying to say here is going forward, it's still hard for me to wrap my mind around the idea that he's going to be the kind of player that Jordan Spieth became, that we expect John Rahm to become, that Brooks Koepka has become, simply because there are those holes in his game. And I just touched on his putting. He's also not a great driver of the golf ball. And look, it is fantastic that everything came together this week, like it did at TPC Harding Park. And I can imagine that's going to happen quite a bit over his career. And it's going to be a Hall of Fame trajectory right now. Let's be honest about it. But I'm still just suspect simply because the tools aren't there on a week-to-week basis.
So here's a stat for you, Rex.
Okay.
I know you think that he's a suspect putter, and he is.
He is.
I mean, you look at the stats, he is a suspect putter. However, if you don't think that he can get hot with the putter 3 to 5 times a year, particularly in the major championships, you're just kidding yourself. So think about this. In the 2 years that he has been a pro, so this is still a very small sample size, Colin Morikawa has been a top 20 putter in the field 7 times. Let me say that again. Colin Morikawa, in the events that he has played, 7 times he has been a top 20 putter in the field. In those 7 events, Colin Morikawa has 5 wins and 2 playoff losses. I want to say that again. 7 times... top 20 putter, 5 wins, 2 playoff losses. If Colin Morikawa putts well, not saying he needs to putt great. He doesn't need to be top 5. He doesn't need to lead the strokes gained category. Just top 20. That's putting well. That's putting good. That's putting decent. A top 20 week. Everyone else is basically playing for second place. Like, that's just how dominant his iron play is. In the strokes gained era since 2004, only Tiger Woods has averaged more than a shot and a half gaining on the field with their approach. That's the company that Colin Morikawa is currently residing in. He is 1.52 strokes gained per round with his approach. And so, yes, statistically, overall, he is not a good putter. In fact, the statistics show that he is a poor
bad putter.
But if you don't think that he can find something 3 to 5 to 7 times a year, that's like a third or a quarter of the events that he's playing. You're kidding yourself. He's a performance-based player. You look at his wins now. He's won at the PGA Championship. He's won a WGC event. He lost in a playoff at the Memorial, and now he wins at the Open Championship. Yes, he might not be able to putt well at the Arnold Palmer Invitationals of the world, but he clearly seems to rise to the moment and is so performance-based in these majors that he's kind of accessing that ability more often than virtually everyone else in the world.
I missed last week because the internet connection was so bad in the UK, along with a lot of the technology that we just addressed on watching your face twist into pain as you read through these stats, like you're just discovering them. Like, oh, like they're golden nuggets. It just fell out of the sky and you're so happy. You're just so delighted.
So you have no rebuttal to.
Well, no. You're putting words in my mouth again. I totally believe, and I think I just said that in my previous comments. That yes, of course. I mean, we've seen it enough. I mean, there are going to be weeks when you're right. He is unbeatable. I don't know, and this is probably a different debate, so I don't want to go down this road too far. And I was thinking about it this morning. Well, I think where we're ending up here very, very quickly in golf is you have 3, 4, maybe even 5 players. Now that Jordan's back, certainly what John Rahm has been able to do, Brooks Koepka is being Brooks Koepka again at major championships. And certainly you put Morikawa. And I mean, I think we're sort of glossing over others. JT would be another one. Any one of these players can be unbeatable on a given week. I mean, we've seen it time and time again. I'm not going to be a prisoner of the moment just because it's been Morikawa this previous week. I simply think that if everything falls into place, and certainly Jordan put words to this on Sunday at Royal St. George's, that a couple bounces, a couple putts go his way. And I always cringe when Jordan Spieth talks about putting poorly and he made every 15 footer that he looks at. That's a little cringeworthy in my mind. However, I think there is something to it. There is something in that sauce where I don't know that you're going to have a player that's going to run away and win, let's say, 3 out of 6 majors, which is amazing. I mean, that's a Tiger-esque run.
Colin just did 2 out of 8.
I know, 2 out of 8 is very impressive, but I don't see, simply because of the competition. And again, I'm addressing this as a collective. I'm not looking at each one of these players and picking them apart like I've been doing with Morikawa. This is just more from 30,000 feet looking down. You're thinking to yourself, Jordan Spieth only needed a couple bounces on Sunday. Even John Rahm just needed a couple more bounces to go his way, maybe a putt here and there. And both of them had great weeks. However, if you look at the big picture, I simply think these could go, at least that one, could have gone so many different ways on Sunday with one bounce here or there. Morikawa got up and down from the hay twice. Absolutely amazing. We can sit here and talk about that birdie run in the middle of the round. It was certainly impressive. I had a chance to spend a lot of time with his caddy, JJ Jakovic, after the round. And having him go through the card, and you know, it was amazing. And there was some things about that trip that I wasn't crazy about, simply because of the protocols and everything that went into it. Having the chance just to sit by the side of the 18th green and with just JJ and I, whereas, you know, normally in that situation, there's 10 of us huddled around the caddy, and that's what we want to talk to, and we want to get these nuggets. There was no one else out there. Having that chance to sit and talk with him where it was just a conversation and the recorder happened to be on, it was really an amazing conversation because he talked me through things that I would never even thought about, as far as his demeanor on the golf course, as far as comparing to how he felt at Harding Park, to how he felt at Royal St. George's, where there was never any nerves, where he felt like he was in whatever we want to define the zone as. I mean, I think relaxed, in a state of sort of just competitive bliss, whatever you want to say about it, he just finds that. And when he does, he's amazing. All right, I've owned my shame. You ready to own yours? Yes?
Yes.
Text exchange, I believe this was Saturday. This wasn't even Sunday night. Lavner, I find myself cheering for Spieth bogeys. Me seems extreme. No, this is what deep-rooted issues look like. And on, you would have, what would have happened, honestly, if Jordan would have won? What would this conversation have been like if Jordan would have won?
Just me sobbing for 30 minutes, you trying to interject some sort of perspective and context into what we just witnessed and one of the more remarkable rises back to the top of the summit that we've seen in recent memory. Just that, I would say.
Sadness,
pity, woe is me. And look, I think my Spieth fandom, I can't even call it like Spieth love. I just think it's like, it's fandom at this point.
You're a fanboy. I mean, you should just own fanboy. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. I mean, I like to think that Jordan and I rose to our respective positions kind of along similar tracks. You know, one of the first tournaments I covered was the 2010 US Junior Amateur, where he was the number one ranked player in the world, and kind of our careers have kind of followed each other ever since then. And so
you're comparing yourself to Jordan Spieth.
No, I'm saying we followed similar tracks.
Okay.
I mean, Jordan's what, 14th in the world? I'd like to think of, I'm at least a top 25 golf writer.
I'd put you top 15 easy.
Sure. So I did not want to see Jordan Spieth rise from the ashes without me there. And so that is why I found myself cheering against him. And look, there were several nervy moments in that final round. There's no doubt about it. Positions where Jordan really could have put even more heat on Colin Morikawa. It's easy to forget now that he shot 66 in the final round. He had two bogeys early that just happened to be offset by that triple breaking eagle putt that he made on 7. Then he was kind of off to the races. But I think you know context is really important when it comes to Jordan Spieth and where you look at where this can go now in the future. 5 months ago, Jordan Spieth was the 219th ranked driver of the golf ball on the PGA Tour. 219. I mean, there's only like 230 players who have teed it up. I mean, he was statistically one of the worst drivers of the golf ball. And yet watching him all last week at Royal St. George's, where there's tall hay on virtually every single hole, you really didn't find yourself holding your breath every time Jordan was over a tee shot, did you? Like, he didn't hit any of those foul balls that we'd grown accustomed to over the past couple of years. Sure, he missed some fairways. I think he finished T17 in terms of fairways hit, but it wasn't those wild shots where he's 20, 30 yards off the edge of the fairway and really getting himself in trouble and making those doubles and triples that had kind of doomed him over the past couple of years. So to me, that was huge progress. And I know you kind of cringed when you said that, you know, Jordan talked about his putting and lamenting some of the miscues that he had with the putter, even though statistically he did putt well and it seemed like he was filling it up from everywhere. To me, that's just kind of like a refreshing reminder of just how far he has come with his long game. The sense that it really even wasn't a question that he wasn't going to put the ball in the best spot to make birdies and that it was all going to come down to the putter again. To me, that very much felt like 2017 when he was playing his best golf and he was statistically one of the best iron players on the PGA Tour. To me, it seemed like we jumped ahead and we've totally forgotten what these last 4 years have been like, because he's getting into a spot now where his long game really isn't even a concern at all.
And it's easy to forget. You're absolutely right. How far back he was not that long ago. I mean, look, it feels like the comeback has been complete. I feel like the comeback is complete now, just for no other reason. Forget about the fact that he put together a great final round and gave it a good run and runner-up finish at a major championship. All of those things. It was just the things he said. I think he truly expected to win. I think he truly felt like, yes, this is exactly where I belonged. He didn't have that pop in the step earlier this season when he won. If you remember correctly, there's a lot of work to do. There were a lot of warning signs. There were some stop signs that he put up for all of us. He wanted to jump on the bandwagon.
And he's still saying that he's progressing. He's, you know, he's going the right direction, but he's not there yet.
Now. But there's confidence now. There was the things he said, I mean, specifically on Friday, not so much on Sunday, but it was, yes, this is where I expect to be. And it just a fine point. I would argue he lost that tournament with back-to-back bogeys to finish Saturday's round, which led him to march straight to the putting green and blow off the media, simply because I think he knew how important that was more so than any of us. Is he knew that he played his way out of the final group, which is always something that you're thinking to yourself, if I can just be in the final group, I can stare this guy in the eye. And the other thing is it's not giving yourself any momentum going into the final round. You could just see he was seeding.
Yeah. I think when you look at Jordan Spieth now in the major championships, I don't think this is like 2015 or even like 2017, you know, the depth and the strength at the top of the world. Specifically, when you look at a guy who's oozing with confidence like John Rahm, or a guy who's just absolutely brilliant with the irons, and as you've mentioned, a streaky putter like Colin Morikawa, I think Jordan needs to have these major rounds be cleaner. And by that, I mean you can't have the 3-putt on 17 on Saturday. You can't have the 2-foot miss on the 54th hole of a tournament. Can't have those early bogeys on Sunday. I mean, so there's just these little things that he has to clean up. And I think that's different than even, you know, 4 or 6 years ago, is that the guys who are at the top now are that much better. And so they're not making those mistakes. And so Jordan, who is still not a great driver of the golf ball, is still not on Morikawa's level with his irons. His putter can betray him at times. He needs to be close to playing perfect golf, when I don't think in 2015 or 2017 he needed to get to that point. And so if he could just clean it up, and I think that's largely a byproduct of not being in that position over the past couple of years, he'll get to that point. He'll probably get to that point in April. But with Spieth's skill set, he needs to be cleaner if he wants to kind of match the brilliance that we've seen now of John Rahm and Colin Morikawa, who to me have really separated themselves from the other world-class players.
I was on a plane ride home yesterday from the United Kingdom with Morikawa, and there is not a cooler sight than watching someone unpack and getting ready to deplane when we landed in Atlanta and pulling that box from the overhead and knowing, I know what's in the box.
Were you sitting in first class with him?
I was not, but I could see him from where I was sitting back in steerage.
Do people recognize him?
Yeah, no, I think everybody on the plane, because again, it was we were coming from England, and I think the vast majority of people were either, there were a lot of players, a lot of caddies, a lot of media types, but even I think even the regular people, you know, the everyday folk on the plane had an idea of who he was. And it was fun to watch. I mean, I think what was interesting, and I'm not going to name any names here, but sitting in the lounge.
Name them. Waiting, name them.
No, I'm not going to do that because and you'll understand why. Sitting in the lounge waiting for the flight from London Heathrow Airport to Atlanta, we all had to show up really early, like so early. It was stupid. And so we're all kind of sitting there at 5 a.m. And there are a couple players and caddies who had not gone to sleep. And I felt sorry for them. Like, trust me, I have gone deep with the best of them. And I've shown up at an airport and felt like I don't know if I'm going to make it through this flight. It's going to be a long day. There was about three or four players and about five or six caddies. I know, be shocked there, who had not gone to sleep the night before, who had not taken a shower and had not stopped drinking.
There was a great tweet. I'm sure you missed it by our buddy, Jason Sobel, who said that Colin Morikawa is the kind of guy who's going to return the claret jug better than what he found it.
It's going to be cleaner.
Which is certainly going to be the case after Shane Lowry having
well, all of this is, having, wait a minute, all this 2 years. Is to be said, all this is to be said, Morikawa looked fresh as a daisy.
Yeah.
Like you could tell he had finished up and he and JJ and mine had gone, I think they were going to go have a glass of wine like they did at TPC Harding Park and sort of talk about it. But that was the extent of it. I don't know what, maybe some chocolate milk went into the claret jug that night, but that's it. That's all I could imagine went in there.
So it is interesting now when you spin this forward, because if you remember from the PGA Championship, Colin kind of had a letdown, and he'll be the first to admit it, that he didn't play as well as he wanted to coming off that PGA Championship victory. He missed three cuts in the fall. Just, he said he really struggled with kind of resetting his goals. You know, so much had happened so quickly, but I think with the way that the schedule is set now, he's departing on Sunday for the Olympics, where you will be. Then he has the WGC, then three playoff events, then the Ryder Cup. I think there's enough to keep him focused here and to not kind of have that letdown that he experienced after TPC Harding Park. You did touch on it briefly. What were your impressions of covering this Open Championship? An Open Championship like we haven't seen before, not just because there was 32,000 fans, which was by far the most we've had of the COVID era, but all of these restrictions, very few American media members who were there. Kind of, how would you sum up the week?
This isn't a visual medium, so I apologize, but I'm going to scan just so you can see the camera to the side of my desk. See that? That is a stack of COVID-19 tests that I still have to take.
Still have to take?
Well, yeah, because I leave for the Olympics, as you pointed out. So yeah, I have to, yes. But I took 12 tests in 11 days. And some of them are self-administered, which, by the way, I hadn't done the self-administered test. And I don't know why, but you are not gentle when you self-administer a test. I think I drew blood once with one of the swabs up my nose. Like, it was so hard. I'm crying. I'm gagging myself.
You just catch the little brain matter on the end of it.
Little brain matter. Yeah, no, it was fine. I wrote about this on Monday on my way home because I was taking, as you pointed out, 32,000 people a day on the golf course, which was full capacity, pretty much as close as we've been to full capacity since Thursday at the Players Championship last year before the pandemic shut everything down. And there was an element to, and I talked to a couple of players who, you know, were finishing up early on Sunday, Rory being one of them, about what it felt like coming down sort of that amphitheater. And you've seen it enough time. You know what it's like. I mean, the fans are very well educated. They're very appreciative. They're there early. Like, they start queuing up at 8 o'clock in the morning. They want to see that first group come in and cheer all day long. And for the first time in a long time, despite all of the protocols, and look, there was plenty of complaining from players and caddies last week because it felt like we took a step back in time as far as a tour, a sport, because at least here in the United States on the PGA Tour, we've seemed to have come out the other side. It felt like we were starting from scratch as far as the testing and the protocols and having to stay in buddy groups and everything else. All that being said, I think after four rounds and having the opportunity to play a tournament like that, that specific tournament in front of that many people, again, a very, very appreciative crowd, I think everyone took something away that had been missing for a long time. We've talked about this a lot, about it's different when you're playing in front of no people. The TV product's fine. Like, we've addressed this, but the actual playing inside ropes with no one there to cheer you, I feel like it took away for a lot of players, the experience. And for the first time, again, since the Players last year, that experience returned.
It is crazy when you think about these seven majors in an 11-month span, just how far that we've come. You were at the 2020 PGA Championship, also won by Colin Morikawa. I mean, there was maybe 30 media members there total when you consider cameramen, writers, photogs. I mean, it was a bare bones crew with hardly anyone on the property. And then you fast forward 11 months in a location in the UK where restrictions, as you mentioned, are really strict. And yet you had 32,000 fans on site. I did want to get your kind of impressions of this, Rex, with seven majors in 11 months span. Obviously we've never had that before. Now need to wait 9 months until the next major championship with the 2022 Masters. How would you rank these seven majors? You can rank them any way you want. You can rank them in terms of which ones were the most fun to cover, which were the most exciting finishes, which
we want to do a list
best majors. Yes. How would you rank the majors? And you can start from seven, because that's probably easier than naming them the best.
That makes me really excited. You're catching me flat footed, but I actually love this.
All right, should I start? You want me to start?
Do you have a list? Yeah, if you have your list, go, because I want to think this through. Go ahead. Yeah, go.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start with the quote unquote worst of the seven major championships over the past 11 months. And to me, this one is easy. Unfortunately, it's Dustin. Someone has to be last. It's Dustin Johnson at the 2020 Masters. Look, we were so grateful to be able to just have a Masters in 2020 with all that we'd endured throughout the pandemic, especially in the springtime when we really didn't know what the immediate future held. Just being able to have a Masters was unbelievable. The fall foliage at Augusta National. That said, I hope we never have it again. The golf course played totally different. It was competing with football. Georgia was playing that weekend. It was very upsetting. And quite frankly, it was kind of a boring Masters tournament with Dustin Johnson pulling away and eventually winning by five shots. To me, Dustin Johnson 2020 Masters was the quote unquote worst. Someone's got to be worst if we're going to rank these seven majors over the last 7 months. What else you got?
I'm going to go a different way. I'm going to go with Colin Morikawa at the PGA Championship at Harding Park.
Was the worst.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with Morikawa. And look, it was entertaining and it was fun, but I think we were both there, and you can agree that not having the crowds there, that was the first time that it felt absolutely surreal. There was nothing enjoyable about that experience. California was still on lockdown. You and I were still locked in a hotel. Everything about the experience, I just didn't enjoy it. And again, this doesn't take anything away from Morikawa. It was a great victory, a little flat coming down the finish simply because of how dominant.
A little flat.
He drove the green. I'll give him that. Yes.
He also chipped it on 14. He drove the green on 16 and made a 7-footer for eagle to win the golf tournament. I mean, he shot 65, 64 on the weekend.
That's my seven.
Are you not entertained?
By comparison, again, this is all by comparison, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
All right. So I'm going to just rifle through these because otherwise this is going to take an hour. So we had DJ at seven.
You got somewhere to be?
Unfortunately, I have another Masters tournament with Hideki at number six. That was kind of a sleepy tournament as well. Until Hideki kind of had those late wobbles on 15. There was at least a little bit of drama on 16D, but that of course was quickly vanished after Xander Schauffele. He said he caught a wind gust. I think he just hit a terrible shot at the absolute wrong time and found the water on 16. So that was my six. Number five, we're going to go with Bryson DeChambeau. Yes, it was a game changing, at least it felt like a game changing moment at Wingfoot with how he won that golf tournament. It really seemed to signal his arrival and potentially kind of a revolutionary moment for the game. We'll see if that pans out. We can actually touch on Bryson later, but to me, that was number six. Of course, as you mentioned with the PGA, there were no fans there as well, which is why I had Colin at number four. And I know you did not like the experience at Harding Park, and I'm sure you were not alone. I kind of put that the newness factor, the novelty of it, of just having the first major back. To me, there was something unique about that that kind of separated it from all of the other no fan events. And I thought the leaderboard was terrific. I think you had eight or nine players who within one shot of the lead heading down the stretch, a lot of big names as well. The Colin Morikawa Open Championship is what I would put at number three, just an absolute brilliance, and kind of established himself as a historic player. We've touched on that. Don't need to go there any further. John Rahm, to me, the second best major of this stretch, the 2021 U.S. Open. 10 players, Rex, within one shot of the lead. Literally, if you could think of a big-name player in golf, he was up there. Brooks, Bryson, Rory, Xander, Louis, and then Rahm breaking through with the birdie-birdie finish to end. And then, of course, and I don't think there's any doubt about this, the best major in the last 11 months was Phil Mickelson at the 2021 PGA Championship. It wasn't necessarily a compelling back nine. It wasn't like Phil went bananas, like he said at the Masters, to win like in 2004. I mean, this was kind of a snoozer at the end. However, just the sheer unbelievable nature in which he won that golf tournament. Basically, he had not done anything for the past year, and he hasn't done anything since. But for him to pop up and win that major and to beat big, bad Brooks Koepka, the best major player by far of the last 5 years, and to have that incredible scene on the 72nd hole when we nearly got trampled to death, to me was by far the most memorable major tournament of the last 11 months. That's my spiel. What is yours?
Appreciate you gasbagging when I went through my list. I'm going to cut straight to the chase. You and I had one and two the same. I agree with you.
Good.
Phil Mickelson, the actual competition itself, at least late, it wasn't enough to catch your attention. But when you watch something historic, when you watch just the way the crowds were reacting, everything about it, it was just a very, very special moment. By far, the best of the seven. And yeah, I went with Rahm as well at the U.S. Open. That was more for the competition, just based more on what he did and maybe what Louis didn't do. I mean, that we can sit and debate that a little bit. But the birdie of the last hole, the way he did it, to do it in dramatic fashion, to have it sort of harken back to Tiger Woods doing what he did at Torrey Pines all those years ago on the 72nd green. I think those two were pretty easy. I'll jump back ahead. I had Hideki winning the Masters at six. I think that was yours as well.
Yes. Yeah. We matched there.
It's simply because, and again, don't take anything away from this, it wasn't Augusta still. And I know they had limited patrons. It felt more like friends and family at the time, but it just didn't feel, you didn't have the roars in the trees. It just didn't have the same thing. I actually liked the competition. I enjoyed watching Hideki. He was kind of surgical.
I mean, for historic purposes and kind of like the significant impact, I mean, Hideki's win is probably going to be as impactful, you know, potentially as Phil winning at age 50.
And I kind of differed here with you. I went with the Masters with DJ. And I know it probably wasn't very exciting with you. This is my fifth pick. It wasn't exciting for me. Seeing the emotion for no other reason from, of all people, Dustin Johnson, who never shows emotion about anything. You know, he never kind of shows anything about anything, if we're being honest. But you got an idea of exactly how much that meant. I mean, it's one thing for Steve Stricker to win and then cry because he cries of everything, right?
He cries if he wins the senior players. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, he has cried, whether if he's win or loss, but he's going to lose the Ryder Cup this year. He's going to cry. Whatever the case may be, he's going to cry. To see DJ get emotional at the end of that shows you how much.
And also, Rex, I'm sure you agree with this. Personal rankings in terms of best experience for us, selfishly, Dustin Johnson, 2020 Masters, by far and away, the number one experience. Being able to see that golf course with no other patrons on it, with maybe 500 people total, was unbelievable. I said at the time, and I stand by it, if I never get to cover another Masters, I can die a happy man, because that experience will never be duplicated. Being able to see that golf course, see that tournament up close and personal like that.
This goes against everything we've talked about on this podcast, because the best one is, it's only the best one or
selfishly,
in that list,
yes.
Because selfishly, the unwashed masses aren't in your way. So you can see the entire golf course.
That's exactly right.
We talked about the experience.
I don't see anything wrong with that. I'm a very selfish person. I didn't want Spieth to win the Open because I wasn't there. And I don't want the Masters to have patrons so I can actually see the action.
Get out of the way, you buffoon. Stop cheering. Move. I want to see the T-Bot. That's fantastic. Now, this one I actually had a hard time with, and this comes down to the fourth pick and the third pick. And I kind of went back and forth. I went with Bryson winning the U.S. Open. And as much as I enjoyed that simply because of what he did, he just sort of took wing foot and broke it over his knee like the big gorilla does. He just picked it up and
come here, you big burly golf course.
This is what I'm going to do to you. Everyone says you're the best. And it felt like he was sort of redefining the game, or maybe taking advantage of it, however Xander put it that time, which he did it so well. But I still think it has to go behind what Morikawa did last week. And this may be a recency bias on my part, just simply because a couple things. One thing, all the things we've addressed about Morikawa, that when he is in full flight, he is this joy to watch. I mean, it's not just him hitting these majestic long irons. It's him making clutch putts and him hitting the fairway when he has to, and him thinking of ways around the golf course, which, by the way, he's also one of the sneaky best interviews. I shouldn't even say sneaky. I mean, I have to put him into the category of probably top three interviews on the PGA Tour now, because he is so insightful. I mean, and he's funny, and I just think I kind of overlooked him maybe a little bit. You've covered him longer than I have. So I would put that. I put Morikawa last week at Royal St. George's at 3 for a lot of different reasons. And it's also, we have not touched
this. That's right, Adam. So basically, we just kind of differed on the Colin PGA Championship victory.
Is that the only one we did? And I think it's worth pointing out, and we didn't touch on this, and I think it's worth just mentioning that the one knock, however manufactured it was against Morikawa, is he had made all of his hay, most of his hay, during the pandemic. When crowds
that was such a stupid criticism.
Again, however manufactured, this sort of puts this all to rest. Like, he did it in front of 32,000 people. He heard all the boos. He heard all the cheers. That one's gone. So if nothing else, again, still a little dubious when it comes to his putting, but he can win in an empty field, or he can win in front of 32,000 people.
I actually think, like, the star players on the PGA Tour thought that was the case, though. I think Jordan kind of he alluded did. To this, or at least yeah. suggested this. I remember Rory talking about it last fall, that the fact that there were not fans on site these major championships was making it easier for these young players who, quite frankly, just didn't know any different and hadn't been in that environment. And to me, that was a bizarre criticism, because good play kind of transcends the environment and the atmosphere that you're in. But Morikawa thankfully ended that rather silly critique.
Well, and I do want to make the quick transition away from that, because you brought up Bryson. And I'll gladly talk about what happened on Friday. I mean, that what happened last week with his equipment manufacturer. And it was surreal. And there's a lot of different elements to this. The one thing that I think that's to spin it forward, and I reached out to the PGA Tour media folks this week, because I felt like Steve Stricker had to do a Zoom call this week and get on a line with reporters, because people have to know, how are you going to manage this team room now? Because you're either Team Bryson or you're Team Brooks. Most players don't want to be on either team, but they're going to have to pick one team or the other. And this is going to be an issue. Stricker has not addressed this. Patrick Harrington, the European captain, was asked last week about it 3 times. It's time for the U.S. captain to have something to say about this.
I think, and I do believe it'll happen, I think they're just going to swallow their pride for 1 week, go about their business. They're going to be cordial to each other. They're going to fist bump each other. And they're going to go on their way. I mean, there's not a seething hatred between the two. I think now they're just kind of
playing it up for
the public. There's a seething hatred between the two. Brooks clearly does not like Bryson.
Bryson's indifferent.
Yes. Like, I think Bryson wants to be liked. I don't think the chemistry issue is going to be a factor at all. They're not going to be paired together, as Brooks said. Not so eloquently last week at Royal St. George's.
But JT piled on last week. JT piled on last week. I had a player text me right after everything happened on Thursday and Friday about, like, what is Stricker going to do? Like, this is a problem. Like, it's not
a problem. You pair Bryson with Patrick Reed, send them out, and they're done.
And you take the L? You take two L's?
Oh, I actually think Bryson and Patrick Reed are a terrific pairing. They're so polarizing, and yet they might be polarizing 51 weeks out of the year. But when you put on the red, white, and blue uniform, they have the full support of the American fans, which is exactly what they're going to have at Whistling Straits. I think their games complement each other. They actually like each other, which is the first part of the equation. To me, it's a no-brainer. You put Bryson with Patrick Reed, send them out, and they're probably going to bring back a point for you. And that way you don't have to this isn't a basketball team. Like, you're not going to have Brooks just refuse to pass the ball to Bryson. I mean, they really should not be mingling at all, except from the team room. And in the team room, they could be separated. They can go play ping pong. One of them can go drink beers in the corner. Like, it's honestly not a big deal. They're not going to sabotage the other.
In a perfect world, Stricker will have a separate team room for Bryson and Patrick in that scenario. I can see them just going, hey, this is where you guys are going to hang out. You have your own little tiny ping pong table. You have your own beer garden. Like, this is your area. Because I do think, and I only say this because I expect at this point Bryson to continue to pile on, because he just can't help himself at this point. Like, it's clear, like, he's just going to keep doing this until Bryson just throws up the, you know, the white flag. Like, I'm done. You beat me, man. Like, I've lost. Like, just leave me alone. Just stop picking on me.
I mean, it's pretty clear he wants no part of the feud.
Oh, he wants absolutely no part of it, but he keeps kind of, I mean, he's trying to do the right thing and pretend like it doesn't bother him. And we all know it bothers him. Like, all of these things bother him. What he did last week, criticizing your own manufacturer, biting the hand, is probably, that one's going to haunt him for a long time. And it says something that when the manufacturer fired back and called their guy that they're paying a lot of money to represent them, an 8-year-old, and that manufacturer, that rep still has a job on Monday morning, that shows you that, look, he probably shouldn't have said it, but there's people inside that building, people who make decisions inside that building, who thought to themselves, well, yeah, he acts like an 8-year-old. Like, I mean, he just spoke the truth. I mean, he just put, you know, truth to words, and that's all he did there. And the fact he still has a job proves that Bryson is difficult. We all knew Bryson was difficult. We just didn't know to what extreme.
Exactly. But he only has to have one other partner.
No, I'm fine with that.
One partner for him. And Patrick Reed's the perfect partner, and their games complement each other.
No, I only thought this became a problem when JT chimes in. And you feel like the other players on the team, not Morikawa, he's way too nice for that. I mean, and I don't know who else is really going to end up on that team because he's got 15 picks apparently. But I don't know that the fact that JT piled on the way he did, it's almost a little shocking where, all right, now this is starting to get out of hand. Like
he tagged him. I think it was lighthearted. And the comment you're referring to is that, you know, a guy who swings 135 miles an hour is surprised that the miss hits go far offline. You'd think Mr. Scientist would have known that.
That sounds lighthearted to you in this context.
He tagged him.
That just means he's not a coward.
Well, JT is not a coward, yes, but that's kind of like his go-to line over the past couple of years. To me, that was a lighthearted dig, and I think it's totally overblown. People might not think that Bryson's their best friend, just like they don't think that Patrick Reed is going to be their best friend, but if you watch a PGA Tour round, just a regular PGA Tour round, all of the players are talking to Bryson throughout the course of the round. They're all talking to Patrick Reed. To me, this friction storyline is really overblown, except when it comes to Brooks. And Brooks has had issues with everyone. You know, Bryson's not the only player in the U.S. team room who Brooks has had issues with. You think Patrick Reed's going to be looking at Brooks?
DJ.
You think DJ is going to be looking at Brooks? I mean,
his own bro.
He has issues with everybody. I would almost argue that among their peers, Bryson might be more popular than Brooks among PGA Tour players.
No, I disagree with that. I mean, look, and Brooks can rub you the wrong way and not being voted player of the year. The year that he won majors, it was a very, very loud testament to how much they don't like his attitude of only 4 weeks out of the year count. Because for the other 200 and something PGA Tour players, those other 52 weeks, I mean, 48 weeks out of the year, they mean something as well, simply because this is what you're going to focus on and you're going to dismiss the rest of the tour. They did not like that. So Rory ended up getting the vote for player of the year when it historically had always gone to the guy who won majors. So I think there is something to be said of, there's a part of Brooks that people don't like, but that being said, Bryson just rubs everybody the wrong way. Phil being maybe the only exception.
Yeah. And which is interesting, because if Phil can somehow put something together over these next 5 or 6 weeks and really give himself some serious consideration,
I think he's a pick, man.
There's no way he's a pick. But if Phil is, then he is Bryson's partner. If Phil is a pick, he is Bryson's partner. There's no doubt about it.
No, that could absolutely work.
I would not want Phil Mickelson on that team. I would want him as a vice captain, no doubt about it. But Phil has not done anything besides that 1 week at Kiawah. And that was a big week. That was the PGA Championship that is operated and owned by the PGA of America, which also operates and owns the Ryder Cup. It is a big week, and Steve Stricker has been friends with Phil Mickelson for 25 years. It is going to be hard to leave him off that team, but I'm not sure even Phil wants to be on that team if he's going to play like this.
Well, he's 17th right now, which is not, I mean, if we look down
that's not a lock.
That it's not a lock, but it's also, it wouldn't be a wild outside the box pick for Steve Stricker. And I think I have a lot of respect for Steve Stricker. He's going to do the one thing that everyone will tell you you have to do as a Ryder Cup captain. And that's not bring any ego into the team room, which is what we can point to all of the players who made the mistake of doing that. Nick Faldo, Tom Watson, however you want to go down the list. Steve Stricker is not going to do that, but he's also got a little company man in him. And we've had this conversation before as well. And it's hard for all those guys who were either on the task force or in that task force universe to suddenly turn their backs to the guys that were on the task force and in that task force universe. We saw it with Davis Love. I think we're going to see it this time. I mean, look, there's a scenario.
Tiger turned his back on Phil the 2019 President's Cup. He didn't burn one of his captain's picks on him. At some point, yes, you have to make a decision about what's best for the team.
No, I agree with that. And I think that Tiger is one thing. I don't know that Steve Stricker has, I don't know how I would put this. I simply don't think that he's going to dance outside the box as much as you think he is.
That was a very delicate way to put that. Look, Phil has to do something over the next month. And I'm not sure that he has had, since you did bring up the Ryder Cup, Rex, on the European side, I did think it was interesting that because of his T12 at the Open Championship, Shane Lowry moved into one of the automatic spots, bumping out your boy, Victor Perez, who does not have a top 10 finish on any tour since March. And so Padraig Harrington has to be licking his chops at the prospect of Shane Lowry moving his way in. Victor Perez moving his way out does not have to use one of his wildcard picks on him. That way he can use it, as he's said and said repeatedly, he's going to use two of his three picks on Ian Poulter, the other pick on Sergio Garcia, and then he can kind of see what he wants to use for that final pick. Maybe it's a player who gets red hot and rips off a couple European Tour wins. Maybe it's a veteran like Justin Rose. Maybe it's a newcomer like Robert McIntyre, who once again played well at the Open Championship. But your boy
is going to break my heart because I had to do the 180. I had to do the turnaround on Victor, just like I've had to do the turnaround on Colin Morikawa. Neither one of those takes age very well. I think he's going to end up being on that list. What was interesting, Padraig Harrington spoke with the media after his final round at Royal St. George's on Sunday, and I thought the numbers that he threw out were very telling. He said he's looking at four veterans and two newcomers for, as you pointed out, sort of that last spot, because we all know who's going to get the first two spots. I think everyone understands that, which means he's going to lean towards a veteran. If the newcomer would be a Victor Perez, whoever else might fall into that category. Certainly Bobby McIntyre is a fun player, the left-hander.
It's going to be Justin Rose in all likelihood.
Just the thinking of those final comments was very telling, because I think he would probably lean over. All right. Since I was across the pond and clearly didn't spend any time over my grill, you sent me pictures of very well-grilled meat as I was eating fish and chips and all kinds of other bad food. I appreciate that. That was a special level of mean.
Thank you. By the way, when you're up as early as we were watching here on the East Coast, the Open Championship, you feel like you have two breakfasts, you have two lunch, you have to have two dinner. So we were firing up the smoker for just about everything. I do have some ribs going on the Gateway Drum later. I'll be sure to send you a couple of photos and videos for that. Rex, you were leaving for Tokyo when, and kind of what's your game plan here for the next 2 weeks?
Leaving Sunday for Tokyo, getting in Monday. I think it's going to be a different Olympics. I think we've all talked about it. I think Rory probably put the best voice to
it. They're talking about an 11th hour cancellation on Tuesday.
I still don't see that happening, although certainly there's been a lot of positive tests. And this goes back to, we had this conversation last June when we get into a situation after the restart where there was a couple positive tests and everyone sort of up at arms and, well, they have to call it all off. I think everyone understands that there's going to be positive tests. I don't know what the tipping point is of the IOC saying that that's too many positive tests, we're not going to do it now. My guess is, based on, again, I can show you the stack of tests that I have to take before I get on the plane on Sunday. Probably the second most telling thing, and this again was from Rory, asked him when he was heading over to Japan, and he's getting in Tuesday night, which gives you an idea that a golf course that he's never seen, a couple time zones away, not quite sure his heart's entirely into it.
Rory seems like he's going to be an ambassador for the sport and wanting to see the Olympics and the games going forward, as opposed to, I want to give myself the best chance to win a medal. Is that your thinking as well?
I think his line was, I'm not a very patriotic person. And which is fine. So it's fine. And again, he's in that weird situation that it's hard for Americans to wrap their mind around. As a Northern Irishman, do you play for Ireland? Do you play for the UK? I mean, it's difficult. It's politically charged. He always felt like he was getting backed into a corner by this decision, because either way, he was always going to alienate a portion of his fan base simply because of how things still are. You and I have seen it firsthand at Portrush at the 2019 Open Championship. I just think that he's a little resentful having to do this. I think he's come around to the idea that, look,
he doesn't have to do this. He doesn't have to do this. He's choosing to. He wants to be an ambassador.
Exactly. He wants to do it for the game of golf. What's fascinating in all this is how, again, he's being backed into a corner where the likes of Dustin Johnson, who he was world number one when he announced that, no, thank you, I don't want to go, and here's my list of reasons. And I'm not debating his reasons. I think he's got a very good list of reasons, but he wasn't the only one. I mean, Adam Scott has made it clear. I don't even think he would have qualified at this point, but there's been no shortage of players who have decided not to do it. Talking with players last week and managers about where this is falling into the schedule, Hideki Matsuyama is probably the best example. I was talking with Bob, his translator, who we all know. We all love Bob. But he pointed out, because of COVID and because of the Olympics, his positive COVID test, and because of the Olympics, Hideki is going to go a month and a half without playing a PGA Tour event, which means he's probably going to drop from 12th on the FedEx Cup points list to maybe outside the top 25, maybe even outside the top 30, which for a player like Hideki this late in the season, that's a big deal. Timing, scheduling, this is still very, very problematic for all of these players.
Are all of these guys actually going to play? So Memphis is the WGC event that starts the 4 days after the tournament in Tokyo wraps up. Are all these guys actually going to play that golf tournament? Are they going to skip a WGC?
I think most of them are going to skip. My guess is John Rahm is going to skip. I would guess Justin Thomas is kind of an outlier. I didn't have a chance to ask him. Certainly, I don't think Rory's going to play. Now, there's a charter flight from Tokyo to Memphis. And even if you're not in the field in Memphis, to give officials credit, they you could get,
I mean,
on that
these guys aren't squeezing into 26C next to the bathroom. I mean, I'm not concerned about the actual flight from Tokyo to Memphis. I'm talking about, you just had an exhausting Open Championship. A lot of those guys headed over for the Scottish early. You have what, 5-6 days to kind of get readjusted to the Eastern time zone. Then you go to Tokyo. Then you come back to Memphis for a WGC. Then you have a week before three in a row for the playoffs. I mean, it's a lot. It's certainly not ideal.
Well, the timing isn't, and this is something that's going to keep coming up. And, you know, you'd like to think that maybe golf can sit down and come up with a better option. And by golf, I mean the PGA Tour. I mean, look, they were part of this push to get golf back into the Olympics. I'd like to see the PGA Tour make some acknowledgments and maybe during an Olympic year, reschedule Memphis, reschedule the playoffs. Whatever it takes, give the players a 1 month window where you're still playing events, but they're not events. If you miss, that you'll feel like you're falling behind, because all those players that don't go to Memphis, where you've got guaranteed points and you have an opportunity sort of pad your playoff advantage, and you have to skip that because of all the reasons you just pointed out, that's problematic. And look, you're making players make this choice between do I do what's best for my country and do what's best for golf and go and represent my country in the Olympics and try to win a medal? Or do I do what's best for me? Do I do what's best for my career at this point? It's not a fair situation for any of these players to be in.
Yeah, keep in mind, $15 million goes to the winner of the FedEx Cup, which will be decided in just 7 weeks' time. Rex, I do look forward to the podcast next week where you'll be live from Tokyo, hopefully enjoying some sushi from your quarantine hotel with some impressions of the golf course. It's going to be the host, both the men and the women. I do look forward to that very much next week. Thank you guys for listening. This Open Championship recap of the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf. We'll talk to you next week.